Testing, testing, testing. Can you hear me? This is Audible Autism.
Hiya, and welcome to another episode of Audible Autism. This is a special episode made up of different features that are intended for you to be able to just sit back and let wash over you. We're going to start with a short talk by me on a topic, and then Odai has selected some easy listening music for you to listen to, and then we're going to finish with a short story from a piece of literature that you can just chill out to. So this particular section of the episode, I want to just, you know, in a regular feature, talk around some ideas that can sometimes be very difficult to understand, or which, when people talk about them, a lot of the time they already assume that you understand the basics of what they're talking about, and they don't feel the need to explain them to you. So in this episode, I'm going to talk about consent. What does consent mean? Consent means giving your permission for someone to do something with you. Most of the time this refers to someone doing something that involves touching you, such as hugging or kissing you, engaging in a sexual act with you, or perhaps performing a healthcare procedure, such as giving you an injection. However, it can also refer to other things. It could refer to things that involve you emotionally. Perhaps someone wants to talk to you about something that might make you sad or upset, so you might not want to talk about that thing right now because you already feel sad or upset, or you don't want to feel worse, or you might need some time to get used to the idea of what this person wants to talk to you about, and you might want to talk about it later, so you consent to talk to that person, just not right now. And if you want to, you can make your consent conditional. Or, what I mean by that is, you can make your consent conditional, and that thing can occur, but only if something else happens. So, for example, you might be willing to speak to that person about the thing that might make you feel sad or upset, but you want to talk to them about it at a different time, when you're willing to, you know, take that on. Consent can also refer to not just you as a person, but also things that belong to you. And I think people might be able to understand that a little bit better. So, for example, people should always ask you for your consent before they borrow things that belong to you, like food, or your laptop. You might want to say to a friend, sure, you can use my laptop whenever you want to, and that might seem like they're no longer asking you for your permission, but that's just giving them automatic consent that you have the power to take back any time. You're still saying that it's okay every time, you're just not having to say yes and have that conversation every time. But you are saying yes at least once. So in its most basic form, consent is something that someone should ask you for, where if they went ahead and just did that thing without asking you, you might feel like a personal boundary has been crossed, or that you've been violated in some way, or generally like something is wrong there. Consent is also something that, although you should be asked for it by other people, you should also ask other people for. To give you an example, if you want someone's crisp, then you should ask them if you can have the crisp and wait for the answer before you take it. Now, a crisp might seem like a really small thing, but the reason that's important is because you don't know what their plans were for that crisp. They might have been saving it to give it to someone else, they might have been really looking forward to it, and they might be really annoyed if you just take it. Or, maybe, they would say yes if you ask them because they don't mind you having the crisp, but also, they just dropped it on the floor. And actually, if you ask them if you can have the crisp, they might say, sure, but it has just been on the floor, just so you know. And suddenly, you might not want that crisp anymore. So, asking for consent isn't just a good idea, it also means that you're giving people the chance to give you information that might change your mind if you had access to it. That's the nature of informed consent. And the more personal the thing you want to do, the more important it is that you ask the other person that you want to do that thing with if you can do it. This is particularly important with romantic and sexual stuff, because sometimes our media can tell us that it's just fine to just start trying to kiss or touch someone intimately. But you should always make sure that someone is okay with that before you start trying to touch or kiss someone. And if you're ever in doubt about whether that's okay, then you should always ask with words, and they should be able to say back that that is okay. If someone can't do that, and there's a variety of reasons for why they might not be able to, perhaps they've drunk a lot of alcohol, or perhaps they're asleep, or they have a condition that makes it difficult for them to understand what it is that you want to do, then they can't give you informed consent, and you just shouldn't do it. As a general rule, if someone can't say no, then they can't say yes either. And you might want something, but if that person can't give it to you, then you shouldn't just take it. That's not consensual, and you might hurt them without meaning to. And none of us want to do that. So in an ideal world, people should always ask for your consent when they want to do something. We have already have laws in place around certain things that you need to consent to, such as having healthcare procedures like injections, or physical acts that involve touching, sexual or not. And there are also laws about what companies and individuals have to do to protect information that they hold about you. But sometimes it's just not that clear. So if you're worried about a friend and you want to talk to another person about them, do you need their consent to do so? What if you ask someone if you can hug them, and they look really uncomfortable about it, and you're not sure if they're agreeing, but they verbally say yes to you? What if you you know someone quite well, and you want to pat them on the back, but you've never actually asked them, and you know that you don't like being patted on the back? What should you do then? Those are all really good questions that I can't really get into in the few minutes that we have available to talk about this stuff. But I did just want to mention it in order to acknowledge that when it comes to consent, trying to work out whether someone is or isn't okay without asking them questions that might actually annoy them can be really hard. And you're not the only person who has to face those questions. We all have to face them. And it depends very much on the person and the situation that you're dealing with. But as a general rule, if you would feel unhappy if someone were to do something to you without asking for your consent, then you shouldn't do that thing to another person without asking them for their consent. And that is what I would really like you to take away from this episode. So we'll leave it there for now. This was obviously the first of what I hope will be many segments. If you do have any questions about what I've talked about, or you would like to suggest any other ideas that could do with an easy-to-understand explanation, then just email us at team@audibleautism.com and we'll try to help. Thanks very much for listening.
This is Otto, and I'm just here to say that right about now you're getting into the section where you'll hear a couple selections of music that will sort of function as a journey of sorts for you to listen to and just relax to. So, enjoy. listeners, this is some light listening from us at Audible Autism for you to take in and relax to. The subject of this episode being Treasure Island. The book was published on the 14th of November, 1893, and is about the tale of young Jim Hawkins, son of an innkeeper, and his adventure on the high seas looking for the buried treasure of Captain Flint. The book was author Robert Louis Stevenson's first literary success due to its exciting combination of the then popular Desert Island stories, which tended to feature treasure-hungry pirates and native lands, as well as the Navy Venture story, where a capable leader would be put into realistic settings and events. Sarah will be doing the reading and focusing on chapter 26. Enjoy.
Treasure Island, chapter 26, Israel Hands. The wind, serving us to a desire, now hauled into the west. We could run so much the easier from the northwest corner of the island to the mouth of the North Inlet. Only, as we had no power to anchor and dared not beach her till the tide had flowed a good deal farther, time hung on our hands. The coxswain told me how to lay the ship to. After a good many trials I succeeded, and we both sat in silence over another meal. "Captain," he said at length with that same uncomfortable smile, "here's my old shipmate, O'Brien. Suppose you was to heave him overboard. I ain't particular as a rule, and I don't take no blame for settling his hash, but I don't reckon him ornamental now, do you? I'm not strong enough, and I don't like the job. And there he lies for me," said I. "This here's a unlucky ship, this Hispaniola, Jim," he went on, blinking. "There's a power of men been killed in this Hispaniola, a sight of poor seamen dead and gone since you and me took ship to Bristol. I never seen such dirty luck, not I. There was this here O'Brien now, he's dead, ain't he? Well now, I'm no scholar, and you're a lad as can read and figure. And to put it straight, do you take it as a dead man is dead for good, or do he come alive again? You can kill the body, Mr. Hands, but not the spirit. You must know that already," I replied. "O'Brien there is in another world, and may be watching us." "Ah," says he, "well, that's unfortunate. Appears as if killing parties was a waste of time. Howsomever, spirits don't count for much, by what I've seen. I'll chance it with the spirits, Jim. And now, you've spoke up free, and I'll take it kind if you'd step down into that there cabin and get me a, well, shiver my timbers, I can't hit the name on it. Well, you get me a bottle of wine, Jim. This here's brandy's too strong for my head." Now, the coxswain's hesitation seemed to be unnatural, and as for the notion of his preferring wine to brandy, I entirely disbelieved it. The whole story was a pretext. He wanted me to leave the deck, so much was plain, but for what purpose I could in no way imagine. His eyes never met mine. They kept wandering to and fro, up and down, now with a look to the sky, now with a flitting glance upon the dead O'Brien. All the time he kept smiling and putting his tongue out in the most guilty, embarrassed manner, so that a child could have told that he was bent on some deception. I was prompt with my answer, however, for I saw where my advantage lay, and that with a fellow so densely stupid I could easily conceal my suspicions to the end. "Some wine," I said. "Far better. Will you have white or red?" "Well, I reckon it's about the blessed same to me, shipmate," he replied. "So it's strong, and plenty of it. What's the odds?" "All right," I answered. "I'll bring you port, Mr. Hands, but I'll have to dig for it." With that, I scuttled down the companion with all the noise I could, slipped off my shoes, ran quietly along the sparred gallery, mounted the forecastle ladder, and popped my head out of the fore companion. I knew he would not expect to see me there, yet I took every precaution possible, and certainly the worst of my suspicions proved too true. He had risen from his position to his hands and knees, and though his leg obviously hurt him pretty sharply when he moved, for I could hear him stifle a groan, yet it was at a good rattling rate that he trailed himself across the deck. In half a minute he had reached the port scuppers and picked out a coil of rope, a long knife, or rather a short dirk, discoloured to the hilt with blood. He looked upon it for a moment, thrusting forth his underjaw, tried the point upon his hand, and then, hastily concealing it in the bosom of his jacket, trundled back again into his old place against the bulwark. That was all I was required to know. Israel could move about, he was now armed, and if he had been at so much trouble to get rid of me, it was plain that I was meant to be the victim. What he would do afterwards, whether he would try to crawl right across the island from North Inlet to the camp among the swamps, or whether he would fire Long Tom, trusting that his own comrades might come first to help him, was, of course, more than I could say. Yet I felt sure I could trust him in one point, since in that our interests jumped together, and that was in the disposition of the schooner. We both desired to have her stranded safe enough, in a sheltered place, and so that, when the time came, she could be got off again with as little labour and danger as might be. And until that was done, I considered that my life could certainly be spared. While I was thus turning the business over in my mind, I had not been idle with my body. I had stolen back to the cabin, slipped once more into my shoes, and laid my hand at random on a bottle of wine, and now, with this for an excuse, I made my reappearance on the deck. Hans lay as I had left him, all fallen together in a bundle, and with his eyelids lowered as though he were too weak to bear the light. He looked up, however, at my coming, knocked the neck off the bottle like a man who had done the same thing often, and took a good swig with his favourite toast of his luck. Then he lay quiet for a little while, and then, pulling out a stick of tobacco, begged me to cut him a quid. "Cut me a chunk of that," says he, "for I haven't no knife and hardly strength enough, so be as I had. Ah, Jim, Jim, I reckon I've missed days. Cut me a quid, as likely it'll be the last, lad, for I'm for my long home and no mistake." "Well," said I, "I'll cut you some tobacco, but if I was you and I thought myself so badly, I would go to my prayers like a Christian man." "Why?" said he. "Now you tell me why." "Why?" I cried. "You were asking me just now about the dead. You've broken your trust. You've lived in sin and lies and blood. There's a man you killed living at your feet this moment, and you ask me why? For God's mercy, Mr. Hans, that's why." I spoke with a little heat, thinking of the bloody dirk he had hidden in his pocket, and designed in his ill thoughts to end me with. He, for his part, took a great draught of the wine, and spoke with most unusual solemnity. "For 30 years, he said, "I've sailed the seas and seen good and bad, better and worse, fair weather and foul, provisions running out, knives going, and what not. Well, now I tell you, I ain't never seen good come of goodness yet. Him as strikes first is my fancy. Dead men don't bite. Them's my views. Amen, so be it. And now you look here," he added, suddenly changing his tone. "We've had about enough of this foolery. The tide's made good enough now. You take my orders, Captain Hawkins, and we'll sail slap in and be done with it." All told, we had scarce 2 miles to run, but the navigation was delicate. The entrance to this northern anchorage was not only narrow and shoal, but lay east and west, so that the schooner must be nicely handled to be got in. I think I was a good prompt subaltern, and I'm very sure that Hans was an excellent pilot, for we went about and about and dodged in, shaving the banks, with a certainty and a neatness that were a pleasure to behold. Scarcely had we passed the heads before the land closed around us. The shores of North Inlet were as thickly wooded as those of the southern anchorage, but the space was longer and narrower, and more like, what in truth it was, the estuary of a river. Right before us, at the southern end, we saw the wreck of a ship in the last stages of dilapidation. It had been a great vessel of 3 masts, but had lain so long exposed to the injuries of the weather that it hung about with great webs of dripping seaweed, and on the deck of it shore bushes had taken root and would now flourish thick with flowers. It was a sad sight, but it showed us that the anchorage was calm. "Now," said Hans, "look there. There's a pet bit to beach a ship in. Fine flat sand, never a cat's paw, trees all around of it, and flowers are blowing like a garding on that old ship." "And once beached," I inquired, "how shall we get her off again?" "Why so," he replied, "you take a line ashore there on the other side at low water, take a turn about one of them big pines, bring it back, take a turn around the capstan, and lie to for the tide. Come high water, all hands take a pull upon the line, and off she comes, sweet as nature. And now, boy, you stand by. We're near the bit now, and she's got too much way on her. Starboard a little, so, steady, starboard, larboard a little, steady, steady." So he issued his commands, which I breathlessly obeyed, till all of a sudden he cried, "Now, my hearty, luff!" And I put the helm hard up, and the Hispaniola swung round rapidly and ran stem on for the low wooded shore. The excitement at these last manoeuvres had somewhat interfered with the watch I had kept hitherto, sharply enough, upon the coxswain. Even then I was still so much interested, waiting for the ship to touch, that I had quite forgotten the peril that hung over my head, and stood craning over the starboard bulwarks and watching the ripples spreading wide before the bows. I might have fallen without a struggle, for my life had not a sudden disquietude seized upon me and made me turn my head. Perhaps I had heard a creak or seen his shadow moving with a tail in my eye. Perhaps it was instinct like a cat's. But sure enough, when I looked around, there was Hans, always halfway towards me, with a dirk in his right hand. We must have both cried aloud when our eyes met, but while mine was a shrill cry of terror, his was a roar of fury like a charging bully's. At the same instant, he threw himself forward, and I leapt sideways towards the bows. As I did so, I let go of the tiller, which sprang sharp to leeward, and I think this saved my life, for it struck Hans across the chest and stopped him, for the moment, dead. Before he could recover, I was safe out of the corner where he had me trapped, with all the deck to dodge about. Just forward of the main mast I stopped, drew a pistol from my pocket, took a cool aim, though he was already turned and was once more coming directly after me, and drew the trigger. The hammer fell, but there followed neither flash nor sound. The priming was useless with seawater. I cursed myself for my neglect. Why had I not, long before, reprimed and reloaded my only weapons? Then I should not have been as now, a mere flying sheep before this butcher. Wounded as I was, it was wonderful how fast he could move, his grizzled hair tumbling over his face, and his face itself as red as a red ensign with his haste and fury. I had no time to try my pistol in the other hand, nor indeed much inclination, for I was sure it would be useless. One thing I saw plainly. I must not simply retreat before him, or he would speedily hold me boxed into the bows, as a moment since he had so nearly boxed me in the stern. Once so caught, and 9 or 10 inches of the blood-stained dirk would be my last experience on this side of eternity. I placed my palms against the main mast, which was of a goodish bigness, and waited, every nerve upon the stretch. Seeing that I meant to dodge, he also paused, and a moment or two passed in feints on his part and corresponding movements upon mine. It was such a game as I had often played at home about the rocks of Black Hill Cove, but never before, you may be sure, with such a wildly beating heart as now. Still, as I say, it was a boy's game, and I thought I could hold my own. At it against an elderly seaman with a wounded thigh. Indeed, my courage had begun to rise so high that I allowed myself a few darting thoughts on what would be the end of the affair, and while I saw certainly that I could spin it out for long, I saw no hope of any ultimate escape. Well, while these things stood thus, suddenly the Hispaniola struck, staggered, ground for an instant into the sand, and then, swift as a blow, canted over to the port side till the deck stood at an angle of 45 degrees, and about a puncheon of water splashed into the scupper holes and lay in a pool between the deck and bulwark. We were both of us capsized in a second, and both of us rolled, almost together, into the scuppers, the dead red cap, with his arms still spread out, tumbling stiffly after us. So near were we, indeed, that my head came against the coxswain's foot with a crack that made my teeth rattle. Blow and all, I was the first afoot again, for Hans had got involved with the dead body. The sudden canting of the ship had made the deck no place for running on. I had to find some new way to escape, and that upon the instant, for my foe was almost touching me. Quick as thought, I sprang into the mizzen shrouds, rattled up hand over hand, and did not draw a breath until I was seated on the crosstrees. I had been saved by being prompt. The dirk had struck not half a foot below me as I pursued my upward flight, and there was Israel Hans, with his mouth open and his face upturned to mine, a perfect statue of surprise and disappointment. Now that I had a moment to myself, I lost no time in changing the priming of my pistol, and then, having one ready for service, and to make assurance doubly sure, I proceeded to draw the load of the other and recharge it fresh from the beginning. My new employment struck Hans all of a heap. He began to see the dice going against him, and after an obvious hesitation, he also hauled himself heavily into the shrouds, and with the dirk in his teeth, began slowly and painfully to mount. It cost him no end of time and groans to haul his wounded leg behind him, and I had quietly finished my arrangements before he was much than a third of the way up. Then, with a pistol in either hand, I addressed him. "One more step, Mr. Hans," said I, "and I'll blow your brains out. Dead men don't bite, you know," I added with a chuckle. He stopped instantly. I could see by the working of his face that he was trying to think, and the process was so slow and laborious that, in my newfound security, I laughed aloud. At last, with a swallow or two, he spoke, his face still wearing the same expression of extreme perplexity. In order to speak, he had to take the dagger from his mouth, but in all else he remained unmoved. "Jim," says he, "I reckon we're fouled, you and me, and we'll have to sign articles. I'd have had you but for that there lurch, but I don't have no luck, not I, and I reckon I'll have to strike, which comes hard, you see, for a master mariner to a ship's yunker like you, Jim." I was drinking in his words and smiling away, as conceited as a cock upon a wall, when, all in a breath, back went his right hand over his shoulder. Something sang like an arrow through the air. I felt a blow, and then a sharp pang, and there I was, pinned by a shoulder to the mast. In the horrid pain and surprise of the moment, I scarce can say it was by my own volition, and I am sure it was without a conscious aim, both my pistols went off, and both escaped out of my hands. They did not fall alone. With a choked cry, the coxswain loosened his grasp upon the shrouds and plunged head first into the water.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this episode. Do apologise about some of the background noise in the story. We didn't realise that was there when we recorded, and we will be making sure that that doesn't happen in future episodes. If you do have any ideas or suggestions about how we could do this better in the future, or if you'd like to contribute some music or a story you'd like to read, do just contact us at team@audibleautism.com. Thanks very much for listening.